Today's What Do You Think program is brought to you by your local Huron County Farm Bureau agents, Bill Weitzel in Pigeon, Corey Vollmer and Deb McBride in Elkton, Casey Yon in Harbor Beach or Ubley, Deb Croswick in Unionville, and Tim Fritz in Bad Axe. Farm Bureau Insurance, Michigan's insurance company.
Okay.
It is.
What's the weather like?
We have snow. Our guest on the program today is Beverly Cobain. She is an author, and she's going to be one of the featured speakers at an upcoming event here. And she's lucky to be in Seattle today because I'm sure they don't have the 4 inches of snow we got overnight that was wet and nasty and slippery. So you can enjoy at least that much. Beverly has written a book called Dying to Be Free. She is an author, a psychiatric nurse, and has learned from firsthand experience about what families go through with suicide. So we thank you for taking time with us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I guess, first of all, your book, do you try to go through all the stages people go through? Is it almost like a guide to letting people know, you know, geez, how can you come to grips and deal with this?
Exactly. That's the intent of the book, is to address people who have lost somebody to suicide. Mm-hmm. So I try to explain why the suicide occurred, what to do, what to expect from that, and how long it will take you to heal, and things to help your healing.
Does anybody in the family really heal from this, or do you just learn how to go on?
Exactly. You never really heal from it. It's going to change your life forever, but you just find a new normal in your life. And at some point, usually it takes around 5 years for most people. At that point, they can not really accept the death, but transition into their new normal life.
Now, you've had to deal with this many times. You are a cousin of Kurt Cobain, who was the lead singer of Nirvana, but you've had other family members. Is this something that seems to have like a family connection?
It has a modeling connection. There's a gene for depression. You know, we think there's a genetic link to depression in families, but there's not really a genetic link to suicide. I think suicide is mostly modeled by somebody else for the person. In this case, I had two uncles who died by suicide. So I think when Kurt got to the point where he could not tolerate his life anymore, he just naturally modeled their behavior.
Are there different levels of attempting suicide? Some, I think, are almost like a cry for help because they almost set themselves up to be saved, and others don't.
Right. There are people who the way they use to attempt suicide. For instance, a lot of women use pills and overdoses, and so men do too. But many people who take a lot of pills then have time to think, oh my gosh, what have I done, and ask for help, because suicide is always a plea for help. It's just a way to get out of your pain, and they usually drop some kind of subtle clues because they don't want to die. They just want to be free of their pain. But the clues that they may drop are so subtle that the average person would not even understand what that meant until after the death.
Is that part of the problem with survivors, is that they're you know, hindsight is 20/20, and they see things in a different light that they didn't pay attention to before, and they may not even have any real relevance to the suicide.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. The survivors are always they're always shocked, devastated, and what happens to them is the pain that their loved one was feeling at the time up to and at the time of their death is now transferred to the survivor. So they are totally shocked, and I've never had a survivor tell me, oh yeah, we knew that was going to happen, or we suspected that that was going to happen. It always comes as a total shock to them, and they spend the first year for sure wondering why and trying to figure out why.
Well, if you were expecting that to happen, you'd have been proactive to make sure it didn't happen, is the way
exactly.
I would see it.
Exactly. I mean, it would be nice if the suicidal person told you how they were feeling, but they don't. So you're left to try to guess what any changes of behavior might mean, and you're probably not going to figure it out because they are masters of deception.
Are there any things people should be looking for? It seems to me, you know, teenagers being moody and, you know, sullen and stuff, that's part of being a teenager at times.
It's normal for teenagers, yes.
So you look at that maybe in hindsight and think, you know, oh, that was a sign, but it, you know, a lot of parents have teenagers that go through this and then they move on to the next step.
That's true. There is absolutely no way to tell who's about to kill themselves. So you have to really look at change and changes in behaviors. And all behavior means something. So you really have to be proactive. And when you notice changes in your loved one, you need to address that right away and not just assume that that's part of their hormones or part of the stage of life they're in.
It seems like it would be something that there'd be a lot of guilt involved in.
Oh.
I mean, you'd not only, you know, have personal guilt, but you'd blame that person for doing this too on a certain level, even though you're feeling
lost and
everything. I would say
that shock, guilt, and blame are the three things most experienced by a new survivor. Yeah, they are wondering what they did that they shouldn't have or what they should have done that they didn't, and none of that really has any relevance, but we all go through it.
And is there light at the end of the tunnel for people who are just starting this process? I mean, can you offer them some hope, or is it different for everybody?
Well, if you determine that something is going on, then you can offer them hope, and that's what they want. They want somebody to stop them, but they're not willing to admit how they feel because of the stigma around suicide, and they're ashamed that they feel this way and that they can't deal with their own life, and they're reluctant to talk about it. But so once they get in the tunnel, it's difficult for them. They are then at the point where it's not that they don't care about their loved ones and their families. It's just that they're not thinking about that now. They're totally aimed toward the end of the tunnel, which to them is the suicide. So if you could offer them some help, if you can find a way to talk to them about it, and I talk about this more at length in the book, and I will talk when I'm speaking in Michigan about this. If you can notice some changes and sit down and talk to the person, and ask the question, which is so important, asking somebody, if you have a suspicion that they might be thinking of ending their life, then yes, you must sit down and ask them the question, because that's the only way you're going to find out. I'm using my morning voice this morning, so it's not usually this deep.
Oh, always deep voices always work on radio.
Oh, good.
It's a great thing. When you're dealing with this situation, it just seems like I've totally lost my train of thought in that question. But
that's okay. Dealing with the loss of somebody that you love by suicide is like a double whammy, because not only did you lose somebody, that you love and you're just devastated by that, but you lost them because they chose to die. And that's kind of a double whammy. It's really difficult to understand why they didn't trust you enough to come and tell you how badly they felt and how much pain they were in. So survivors are just, you know, and then they have, if somebody dies in an accident, people gather around and bring food and stay with the person, and it's a totally different thing with somebody who loses someone to suicide, because nobody knows what to say. And so they come around and they offer, you know, they offer help, but they don't know what to say, so they're afraid of bringing up things that will make the person cry again or whatever. So the survivor is often left with nobody around. You know, people stop coming over because or calling because they burst into tears every time they cry or talk about it. But that's a good thing. And I want people out there who know somebody who has lost somebody to suicide to be willing to be with them and talk to them about their feelings and about the person who died, and The survivor wants to do that.
Well, isn't
it's okay if they cry. Let them cry. It's good for them.
Isn't that like venting their feelings rather than bottling them up and becoming like a pressure cooker, and then
Absolutely.
They go off in the wrong direction?
If survivors don't make some connections where they can talk about the death and talk about their feelings, they have a very difficult time getting through it. It's much better if they go to, say, a survivor of suicide group, a therapist, or just, you know, call a friend and say, come over and talk with me about this. I need to talk. Yes, I'll cry, and yes, I'll feel horrible, but I need to do this because they can't hold it inside. It's too much pain for them.
And do the people who are going through this have to just say, you know, maybe they're thinking, I don't want to dump this on anybody else because I know how painful it is to me, but do they need to get past that part of it?
They do. They do. And it's difficult to talk with family members sometimes because the family members may be in a different stage of recovery than the one person. They'll, like, if there are four other people left in the family, one of them may not want to talk about it at all, just wants to go on and pretend like it didn't happen. Another person may be in the bedroom crying all the time. Another person may be in an anger stage where they're just so angry they can't, you know, they can't calm down and talk. They just want to be angry and treat everybody badly. So they're not always going to be in the same place at the same time. So it's really difficult for you to utilize your family, your immediate family, to help you. So some outside help is, I think, really the best.
And by outside, you mean like professional help?
Yes, I mean like a therapist or a survivors of suicide group. I've been to so many of those, and they're so helpful because it's about the only place you can go besides a therapist and say exactly what you want to say and be angry if you want to and yell and scream and cry and do whatever you want to do, where that's totally acceptable and everybody else knows exactly how you feel. So it's some help to you to know that you're not the only one that feels this way and that it will get better.
Well, you'll learn to live with it.
Well,
more or less.
Yeah, I guess that's a simple way of putting it. Yeah, but there's a lot of work to be done before you get to that stage. Mm-hmm. And that work is called mourning. And it's an active verb. So grief is what you're feeling, and mourning is the work that it takes to get through the grief. And it takes a long time, and it takes hard work.
And are there stages in the grief? Do you go through anger, then you go through acceptance, and then you go through other types of things?
You go through anger and denial, and it takes some people a long time to actually accept that the person is dead and that the person actually did it to himself or herself. And there are other stages too, like anger and blame and that sort of thing, and resistance, where you just resist getting any help. You just think, well, I've got to pull myself up by my bootstraps and get through this, which is very difficult, a very difficult place to be. And eventually, and as I said, this is about a 5-year time span for most people. Eventually, they get to a point where they can find a place within themselves to put this loss and get on with a productive life. And it's hard for them to see that. You know, they will laugh again, and they will be at peace again, and they will have a productive life again. But first, the work.
And we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in 60 seconds, and we'll have more from Bev.
Predict a happy retirement and big tax savings when you make Farm Bureau Insurance part of your retirement plan. Look at the benefits of IRAs, a lifetime retirement income, tax-deferred growth, competitive interest rates, guaranteed minimum rates, and guaranteed safety of your funds. And you'll have the protection of Farm Bureau Life Insurance Company of Michigan, rated one of the 50 most outstanding life insurers in America. So make that call to your Farm Bureau insurance agent today. It's not who you call after retirement, it's who you call before that makes the difference. Farm Bureau Insurance, Michigan's insurance company. Contact one of your local Huron County Farm Bureau agents. Deb Croswick in Unionville, Bill Weitzel in Pigeon, Corey Vollmer or Deb McBride in Elkton, Tim Fritz in Bad Axe, or Casey Yon in Harbor Beach or Ubley.
Okay.
We are back, and our guest today on the program is Beverly Cobain. She's an author. She has a book, Dying to Be Free. She's also going to be here locally in the Bad Axe area next week. So we're going to talk a little bit later on about the presentation that's going to be coming up. But while we've got Bev on the phone, we're going to be talking about some of the things. You wanted to make a point that you don't have to be clinically depressed to commit suicide?
Exactly. So many people, almost wherever you read about depression online or in books and things, that they say that 90% of people who kill themselves are clinically depressed. And that has just not been my experience at all. And I don't believe that's true. Certainly at the time they make up their mind to die, they are not in their right mind because they have so much psychological and emotional pain that they're not thinking clearly. But if we go around looking for depressed people, and I'm not saying that depressed people don't die by suicide because they do, but for the most part, if you're looking for somebody who's dragging around and looking sad and crying, we're going to miss the people who are suicidal. Because suicidal people, and this has been explained to me by my own work and by many people who have lost somebody to suicide, when they're talking about the adjectives that best describe their loved ones, they report traits like, oh, he was loving and funny and carefree and creative. And creative and artistic are huge. They seem to be creative in some way and very artistic. Though she was the outdoor type, she loved sports, she loved life, very caring and giving and active and all those things, which are not how you think of a loser. I was speaking to a man on a boat in Costa Rica one time who was playing a guitar and singing songs, and as I walked by him, I just sort of said, as a joke, I said, play something by Nirvana. And he stopped playing, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, I don't play music written by losers. So there is that mindset out there that think that people who die by suicide are weak or losers, or they're taking the easy way out. It's absolutely the reverse of that. Absolutely. They're just people that are giving and loving and all those other characteristics I named before. And they're not necessarily depressed.
Is that kind
of... They just have so much pain that they can't deal with it anymore.
Is that part of our need to understand why something that we may never really understand? And is that a problem for survivors that they may never really understand? Why?
Yeah, I think they may really never know the reasons why, but what they need to know is simpler than that. It's just that they were in such psychological pain. They were, you know, they've had losses, they've had things that they were grappling with, their plate just got too full, they felt they had no other options. And they also feel, most of them, as though they are a burden on people, and they don't want to be a burden. And even by telling somebody, that will burden them. So those are the main reasons that we don't see it and that they don't talk about it. So you've got to ask the question. That's the most important part. If you have a sense that something is wrong in somebody's life, that they're acting differently in certain ways, then going to them, as I said before, and asking that question, you know, do you ever think of suicide? I see that you're in such pain. Do you ever think of taking your life? Do you ever think of dying? And those sorts of things. Because the person who's listening to that, the suicidal person, will take that, will be relieved. They will take that as permission to talk about what they're feeling. And you can save a life that way.
Is talking really the key in prevention? Is allowing these people to actually get their feelings out? I've for a long time believed that the first step to solving any problem is being able to say it out loud. It kind of puts it in perspective.
Exactly. But who's going to walk up to their mom or somebody else normally and say, I'm thinking about killing myself? Or if, and they may, you know, they may make a statement like, if they're mad at the mom or the dad or somebody, they might say, well, if you don't let me do this, I'm going to kill myself. And sometimes that can be just an empty threat. But if they say that, then they have thought about it. You know, and I think that is the perfect time to sit down with them and say and start talking. You know, okay, thinking about killing yourself. Let's talk about that. How much pain are you in, and what can I do to help you? You know, I can't let you do this, but let's think of something else. The sorts of parental things that most of us do.
If you find this out and you go to get them help, does the person who needs the help have to acknowledge that? Because from what I understand about most types of therapies, they really only work if the person is part of the process.
Well, yeah, and this is the trouble with a lot of men, for one, and a lot of females too. But they don't they feel like going to get help is shameful. I should be able to do this by myself, sort of thing. So I tell parents who have kids, that youngsters, that if they think the kid needs help and the kid doesn't want to go to therapy and talk to anybody, there might be another trusted adult, an aunt, an uncle, a grandmother, somebody who could talk to the kid, would feel comfortable talking with. But I say bribe them.
No,
I do. Use any method you can to get them to the help that they need. And tell them, for instance, if you will go see this therapist and you will go five times and participate, then I will buy you a new iPhone, or I will give you, I will take you to Mexico with me, or whatever you have to do, to whatever they want that you can bribe them with, because it's so important that they make a connection with somebody who can help them.
And do you have to find the right therapist? I've always heard that, you know, you can find one that just doesn't work and the next person will be great for them.
Absolutely. And most therapists now will let you come for a 15-minute chat without charging you to just see if you're a good match. So if you have to go through four or five or six therapists to find one that you feel comfortable with, I would do that. Because, yes, there are therapists out there who will not be helpful in this kind of a case, and there are those out there who are wonderful and very compassionate and helpful.
Because they work best when the patient therapist make a connection that they can work together with.
Yes, yes. Was that a question or was that a statement?
Well, I think it works both ways. But if you want to elaborate on it, how good that works, please.
Well, first of all, nobody's going to talk to somebody they don't trust. And nobody's going to talk to somebody they don't like. You know, they just don't like the way that the person is talking to them. So when they get together, a good therapist will talk about feelings and talk about, and is a good listener, can actively listen and really knows how to get feelings out of the person, and then can suggest other options. And she knows a good therapist will know what other resources are out there. But I think I've been to therapy on and off for years, and the ones I like, the one I have now, who's I just call my tune-up therapist, when I'm feeling like something's going on that I can't deal with or that I need some insight with, I will make an appointment and go talk to her. And she's just so good because she knows, in time, the therapist gets to know you. So I think that's really important when a kid or somebody who's been feeling a lot of emotional pain goes to a therapist. They need to go often enough so the therapist gets to know them a little bit, because then she can refer back to other things, he or she can refer back to other times in your life, and they try to figure out what works for you and then help you to do that.
Terrific. And you have a book, and it's called?
I have two books.
Oh, you have two?
Yeah.
And they are? Because this will help people, you know, if they want to just, you know, read on their own.
Right. The first book is called When Nothing Matters Anymore. And it's a survival guide. Oh, I can't talk now. A survival guide for depressed teens. And that one I wrote, ooh, gosh, a couple years after Kurt's death. And then it's been redone it and revised it and updated it in 2006. So it's very good, and it's been, I've had so many teachers and parents tell me how much that helped them. When they believe a teen might be depressed, then they give the book to the teen to read, and many times it's stolen out of libraries because the kids really relate to it, and parents too. And the one I'm going to be talking about in Bad Acts is called Dying to Be Free. And that is exactly what suicidal people are doing. They want to be free of their pain. And they get to the point where if they have a lot, here's what I think the main push towards suicide is. If somebody is in intolerable emotional pain, they have so much going on, they're just overwhelmed by it, and then they think of suicide. That's the driving force behind suicide. If they never thought of suicide, then somehow that pain would either, they would either talk about it, or somebody would notice it, or they would get medicated, or whatever. But once they think of suicide, they might be shocked that they thought about it for a little while. But then if things don't get better, or if they get worse, they're going to go back to that thought again. And eventually, once they've tried everything they can think of, which may not be all the options, by the way, but everything they can think of, then that's when they're getting closer to the tunnel. And once they get in the tunnel, they're sort of lost.
Okay. And are we in a period where this is on the rise? I mean, there's a lot of stress in our society to begin with the economic downturn and all the hassles families are going through and all of that. Is this kind of like a perfect storm for suicide?
Yes. I've been doing this for 20 years, almost 20 years, and I have seen suicides rise the whole time. So it's not that we're not saving some people. It's that I think more people are just becoming, especially like you said, with the economic downturn, it's never just one thing. But, you know, if somebody loses their home, their job, and then their home, and that's got to cause a lot of guilt and pain and shame, which are things that are on the plate of a suicidal person. I think when I first started doing this, and up until 2 or 3 years ago, the person most likely to kill himself in the United States was a white male over 65. Now it's a white male between 45 and 55. So that's, you know, they're right in the working class there. So I'm, you know, and there could be other, those kinds of things, losing jobs, losing homes, they put strain on a relationship too. So then there may be a divorce in there. It is the perfect storm. Yeah.
And the only thing that can really help is to get those feelings out. Once you've done that, at least you're dealing with them.
Once they're out on the table, then it's a lot easier to deal with them. People can get, you know, they don't just have to talk to one person. They can talk to a lot of people. They can go online and see what other people are doing. But there are some people who just, for instance, men, who just feel like it's their place to bring home the bacon. And if they can't do it anymore, you know, if they're kept from doing that, then, who knows what they will end up thinking. And it isn't that they, as I sort of alluded to before, it isn't that people who consider suicide are thinking about, women kill themselves who have two little children that they loved. But it's when they get in that place where they're not thinking, they can't think about anything else. They're totally focused on suicide. That's the big danger area.
When you talk about talking about it in the internet, that kind of scares me, because you don't really ever know who's on the other end, and we've heard horror stories in the past. How do you find what do you look for, and if you want to seek help that way, how do you find something that's reputable, going to work?
Well, you would go to one of the mental health websites, I guess, although, again, you don't have to be mentally ill to kill yourself. But, there is a problem with kids and the internet and suicide websites. I think it's terrible, and I don't know how a parent keeps kids from going there unless they're constantly monitoring what they're doing on the internet. But I was meaning other places on the internet where you could just learn about, you could find therapists in your area. You can go to a job site, a job website to see if they have any openings. There's a lot of good stuff you can do on the internet, but these sites where the chat rooms are, where kids are there talking about suicide, et cetera, that can be very dangerous, and I would certainly find a way to make sure what my kids were doing online.
Yeah, because you hear the horror stories, and the people are at their most vulnerable when they're going.
And the other thing is that kids use computers often as a way of isolating. So if you've got somebody in your family who is never at the dinner table because they're in their bedroom texting somebody, or they're on the computer and they spend their evening on the computer, that's a form of isolation, and I think that needs to be addressed. I all the teens who are listening now are going to be booing me, but I just think you have to have human contact, face-to-face human contact with people to stay healthy.
And you can't do that in 140 characters or less.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I'm not saying you can't take their phones away or that sort of thing, but I'm just saying there's a time when they need to spend time with the family. There's a time when they need to spend time with their friends, and they're not in their bedroom on the computer isolating. That's one of the signs you look for when you think somebody is having some unhealthy thoughts or plans.
Well, as I get older, it just seems, I see these things where people are tweeting each other in the same room, and it's like, why? Talk to them.
I know. It's crazy making. And of course, I'm, what teens would call an old lady that doesn't text, but I just totally believe, and I mean, sometimes I live by myself, so there are times when I realize I'm spending too much time in my condo. I'm by myself, and I need to get out, because it's just not healthy to isolate yourself and withdraw. And there are times when it just, it's raining out, it's cold, I don't want to go out there. So then I call a friend and talk to somebody. But Facebooking and emailing is not the same as going to lunch with a friend, or going to a movie with a friend, or going to somebody's house and actually making contact.
Well, you miss out on all the subtleties of actually seeing their expression, how they're holding themselves. All these things give you a lot more clues than sometimes the words they say.
Absolutely, and laughter is such a wonderful healing thing. And, you can think something's funny that somebody emailed you about, and you can have a laugh about it. But when you're together, I have a really neat lady friend that I've known for 35 years, and we go walk together 3 times a week. And we laugh so hard. And it's not like, it's not like if I walked at the mall by myself that I would, I might think of something funny, but I'm not going to laugh out loud by myself. But if you're with somebody, there's a lot more opportunity to exchange ideas and be silly and laugh, and that's very healing. And you can't laugh, you can say LOL if you want to on your text, but that's not the same as laughing with somebody and really, really, really having a good guffaw.
Because there's a biochemical reaction when you laugh, and that's important to brain chemistry and staying healthy.
Absolutely. There is a chemical reaction in your brain when you laugh, and it's very healing. It's very good. As far as they know, and they can't really measure transmitters in the brain that well, but as far as we know, laughter lights up one section of the brain and is very healing. And some people will, I mean, you've probably had a time when you started laughing and couldn't stop. You know, you just, even now it's getting silly because you're interrupting other people's dinner or whatever, but you're laughing so hard you just can't stop. And sometimes people will go right into sobbing from that. So you know that there's tension in there that needs to come out. And laughter is just fabulous.
Laugh so hard they cried.
I've done it.
So anyway, you've got the program coming up. It's coming up on the December the 8th. That's a week from tomorrow, December the 8th, a Thursday. It's at the Franklin Inn in Bad Axe. And they're going to have a private breakfast with you if they wish. And that's from 7:45 to 8:45 a.m. And then the conference will really get underway about 9:25, runs till 3:45 in the afternoon. Now, I see from the agenda they sent me that you have several topics you're going to go over, the suicidal mind. There's six myths about suicide. You don't have to give it away if you don't want. the tunnel, and then after lunch there's compounded grief, successful morning. I suppose that means doing it in a healthy way, and survivor's path to healing. So it sounds like you almost take them through the whole thing sequentially.
Yeah, they gave me the agenda, so they want me to go through, you know, just talk about what's in the book, because I'm telling you, I've had so many people, including Mary Grierbeel, if I'm saying her name right, who is the person who was my contact from Bad Axe, who called me and or emailed me and told me how much the book helped her when she lost her son. So then she's sort of the driving force behind all this, I think, and has gathered, you know, people and the place, and she discerned that this agenda would be what she would want to hear, and so that's what we're going to do.
And if people have questions or want to register to come, they can call 269-2962, 269-2962. I appreciate you taking time with us today, Beverly. One quick question, you know, when you talk about your cousin Kurt, that has to really complicate matters when somebody's that big of a celebrity and the whole world's looking in.
Yeah, that was the whole reason for the first book, was because I so worried about kids who were really into the band and Kurt. And Kurt was bipolar, and I wanted people to know that there was a reason. I wanted kids to know there was a reason he was the way he was, and there was something he could have done about it if he'd only known, so, or if somebody would have helped him. So that was, and especially his being the third suicide in my family, I was going, what? You know, what is going on in my family? And, so then I started, I was already a psychiatric nurse. So I saw this coming with Kurt. I actually saw it coming and had talked to his grandfather about it. But before his grandfather could do anything, who was the closest person to Kurt at that time, within 30 days after I talked to his grandfather, Kurt was dead. So.
And you have to wonder about the people around him if they're more worried about getting the show on rather than the person.
Oh, yeah, I did, and I do, but, yeah.
That's a whole nother book, probably.
That's another book, yes.
Well, thanks for taking time with us today, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday, week from tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our guest today on the program has been Beverly Cobain, and her book, Dying to Be Free, will be the focus of that program, which is coming up again a week from tomorrow. That'll be on December the 8th, Thursday of next week, at the Franklin Inn of Bad Axe. Starts with a breakfast at 7:45, then the program itself, 9:25 till 3:45 p.m. You can call Rhonda if you'd like more information or to register. You can give her a call at 269-2962, 269-2962. Coming up at 11 o'clock, we'll clue you in on all the latest in the news.
Today's What Do You Think program was brought to you by your local Huron County Farm Bureau agents, Bill Weitzel in Pigeon, Corey Vollmer and Deb McBride in Elkton, Casey Yon in Harbor Beach or Ubley, Deb Croswick in Unionville, and Tim Fritz in Bad Axe. Farm Bureau Insurance, Michigan's insurance company.